It's hard to remember now, but the internet used to be fun.
I can't believe how easy it is to surf the net.
Surf's up.
On Long Shadow, Breaking the Internet, we'll trace how a tool that once fueled democracy...
Opposition activists organized the march on Facebook.
...became a weapon aimed at the very heart of it.
You're watching the unraveling of our democracy right now.
From Longlead and PRX, this is Long Shadow, Breaking the Internet. Subscribe now wherever you get your podcasts.
Anywhere you go that has seasons, people have summer food cravings they look forward to all year. Creamed corn in the south, Italian ice anywhere, pink soup in the Baltics.
Yep, slip that in there, pink beet soup.
They beat spoons against their bowls in anticipation, and later they set a record for most people eating pink soup at the same time.
Today on The World, we're all about food. We'll visit the terraced tea fields in Japan.
And a farm breeding happy chickens in Italy.
To see if we can find better life for chickens. That is a wonderful animal.
Plus, no lack of confidence about the best Chinese barbecue.
I would have to say that, you know, if you really want the best, either use this recipe or come to Hong Kong.
That's a very diplomatic way of putting it, I gotta say.
The Summer Food Show coming up today on The World.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Soraya Wintersmith in for Carolyn Beeler. Glad you're with us today.
We're going to take you on a global culinary tour this hour. It's a show with spice and flavor and some mouth-watering cultural mashups.
Yes, we're talking about food from all over the world. And as we head toward a holiday weekend, where better to start than with the classic summertime staple, barbecue? And Chef Hugh Mangum, whose new book is called Barbecue, Smoked and Grilled Recipes from Across the Globe.
I described to Chef Mangum what I consider to be the conventional wisdom on preparing barbecue, cooking meat low and slow over a fire. He told me politely that the fire part is correct, but that barbecue is way more than just the how.
What defines barbecue to me is what is the celebratory food that is cooked over live fire, via smoke or coal or direct heat that is celebratory in people's rituals. It's a celebration food, whether it's a family of four, whether it's a gathering of 40. To me, barbecue is very much a nurturing food. It's how I connected with my father, who was from Texas. All food should be cooked from the heart, in my opinion. You know, that's the best food. But I do believe that barbecue, in its truest sense, is just a gathering, nurturous food that is cooked utilizing fire.
I love that celebratory aspect that you bring in there. Where does the word barbecue come from? It's a Spanish word, right?
Yes, exactly. Barbacoa comes from Spanish cooking and cuisine, and it's been around for hundreds of years.
And what does it mean literally, barbacoa?
The truest sense of barbacoa is meat that is cooked in the ground using fire and or coals.
Got it. So in the U.S., barbecue gets traced back to slavery. African-Americans, as I understand it, use these cooking techniques to prepare the cuts of meat they could get access to. Is that a central global narrative, kind of people living under terrible conditions and through that deprivation had to figure out how to make do with what they had access to taste good?
Yeah. I mean, as a general rule, yes, it was the off cuts. It was the cuts that were not as desirable to the, you know, however you want, you know, the hierarchy, the upper class. They were using quick cooking cuts of meat and, you know, the heads, the necks, the legs, you know, the hams, everything that took longer to cook and break down because of intermuscular structure was tended to be kind of, you know, cast away to the people that were lesser at the time. And, you know, they used ingenuity to figure out how to cook those cuts to get the best out of them. And also smoking, you know, also became a preservation tool as well.
Yeah, aside from the U.S., where do we see that barbecue story kind of coming alive?
There's versions of it in Mexico. There's versions of all over the Czech Republic, all of those kind of Eastern Bloc places as well. Then you get into Southeast Asia, and there's versions of cooking, but it's more high heat. But it's, you know, again, it's all of the things that were kind of cast away initially and then cooked that way.
Well, I mean, this is a perfect moment to bring in Mei Chow, a chef in Hong Kong and contributor to this book. Hi, Mei. How are you?
Hi, how are you?
I'm doing well. So I'll ask you in a second about what you brought specifically to this cookbook that we've been talking about with Hugh. But what are your go-to components for a Hong Kong barbecue?
Hong Kong barbecue, there's two types. So what we're most renowned for, because we're in the southern part of China, is a huge part of Cantonese cuisine is roasted meats. So what that means is a few iconic things that we roast. We do roasted meats is a super crispy skin pork belly. We do a char siu, which is actually a roasted pork shoulder with a glazed honey with a sweet and savory marinade. And also we roast duck and goose, and it's super common, and you'll see it on the streets where we'll have it for lunch over rice. If it's in a fancy dinner, it'll be, you know, just a main course. And so, so I think, you know, for the one that I specifically chose, which is the char siu, is kind of like a Hong Kong icon. So if you ever come to Hong Kong, you must have it.
Yeah, so tell us more about char siu, because I have seen this on menus in pretty much every Chinese restaurant I've ever eaten at. But for purists, what is char siu really about?
So char siu, if you literally translate it from Cantonese, it literally means roast on a fork. And so our ovens are, these barbecue ovens are actually vertical ovens. And what we're able to do is we first marinate in a sweet and savory marinade. And always we have to pick a certain part of the pork that's soft, but also has great marbling, because we want juicy, kind of like that
cooling
fattiness
that fat
that's coming through. You want the fat. You don't want to have that fat is what makes or breaks it. So you marinate it. And what you do is you skewer it into these long skewers and you hang it inside the oven.
The way you're describing it, I feel like I've never had it authentically here in the U.S. Have you ever eaten authentic char siu in the U.S., Mei Chow?
I have my love for, you know, Chinese diaspora food. And so, you know, I do my fair trade of orange chicken, you know, and char siu. I would have to say that, you know, if you really want the best, either use this recipe or come to Hong Kong.
That's a very diplomatic way of putting it, I gotta say. May, I want to pick up on Hugh's point about barbecue being the celebratory food kind of event. When you throw a typical Hong Kong barbecue, what is the scene like? Is it at someone's home, or do you typically go to a restaurant?
We typically go to restaurants because Chinese barbecue is actually quite technical. Like, it's a huge drum that people barbecue in. So it's not, there's a different type of barbecue that we do friends, but I think my American friends don't understand, because it's literally, it's a fork with two prongs, and that's a different type of barbecue over an open fire, and you can only ever skewer two chicken wings on it. And my friends don't understand why you would spend so much time, you know, barbecuing.
And what do you tell them? What
so
is your argument?
Productivity. It's the romance of barbecue, of like all things Chinese. They like sitting around a fire and just chit-chatting, and it's strategic. You need to cook the easy-to-cook stuff first, like the sausages, and then you move on to the chicken wings. You never start with chicken wings. That's an amateur move. We take roasted meats really seriously, so I think especially in the roasted duck and the roasted goose category, we really have the masters who do it.
And something May just said that like resonates as well is like sitting around that fire. There's something so primal about what barbecue truly is in any iteration. There's something about gathering around a fire. That's how civilization started, essentially, once we figured out fire. And it's always been something we've sought out. And food is just the best, most celebratory vessel to do that.
Well, it kind of feels like you're anticipating my next question, Hugh, because in Spain, you've got barbecued root vegetables. In Egypt, there's spiced fish that's barbecued. Aside from the fire, heat, and smoke, what is the common thread?
Yeah, so, you know, again, fire is the common thread. Celebration is the common thread, but also getting together. Generally, you never think about eating barbecue alone. It's not something you go out to eat solo. It's something that you do with people, you go out to with people. It's shared food. Whether you're in, you know, Tokyo and going to get yakitori at an izakaya, or you're in Australia and you're having some snags, which, you know, are sausages or their version of sausage / hot dogs. It's always something that you're doing amongst people, friends, colleagues. I find it romantic. It's beautiful to me. It's just something that I've always kind of gravitated to.
Chef Hugh Mangum, thank you very much for coming in. And Chef Mei Chow, thank you for joining in from Hong Kong.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for having us.
Hugh's cookbook is Barbecue, Smoked and Grilled Recipes from Across the Globe. We've got the recipes for Mei Chow's char siu and Korean short ribs on our website, theworld.org.
If you search online for heart-healthy recipe, you'll get tips for making things like green smoothies and big leafy salads. And that's fine, but experts say it's time to expand the idea of what healthy eating looks like and take some cues from non-Western countries. The World's Sarah Birnbaum has more.
About 6 months ago, I found out I had high cholesterol, so I went to a nutritionist, and she gave me these handouts, you know, like sample meal plans. There was a picture of overnight oats, a recipe for skinny shrimp scampi, and other kind of Mediterranean diet staples. Tamara Melton knows these handouts well.
Brown rice, chicken breasts, and broccoli, like the most bland meal that is on a plate. It was always some variation of that.
She's a registered dietitian in Atlanta.
Which you're not going to see anything in there about like chana masala or roti, which is what I grew up eating.
Melton is part Trinidadian.
But yes, there is definitely an absence of different cultures' ingredients and then the recipes themselves and the meals themselves. And that's what we were taught to show to people.
Part of it comes down to an information gap. There's limited data on the immune and metabolic impacts of Latin American, Asian, and African diets, especially compared to the mountains of data on the Mediterranean diet. Dr. Godfrey Temba at KCMC University in Moshi, Tanzania, is trying to change that. He studies the eating habits of rural communities in Tanzania's Kilimanjaro region.
Many people in the rural areas eat like plantain. So plantain, this is a green banana. So they cook plantain together with beans, like kidney beans, and this can be served with avocado and some green vegetables.
The dish is called kiburu in the local language. They also drink a beer called mbege, made from ripe bananas and sprouted millet powder. Temba says what surprised him when he visited these villages is that he would meet people well into their 90s, and they were vibrant and energetic and with it.
And they often like rise up at the dawn, they walk to their farms, to the local market, they have their home gardens. They remain very active.
What's their secret? Mbege. Temba's latest study followed a group of 77 men in their 20s and 30s, roughly half from a village and half from a city where the diet is mainly Western food. For 2 weeks, villagers had to eat city food and the city folk had to eat village food, and Temba's team took blood samples along the way. Their results are published in the journal Nature Medicine. They found that switching to the traditional African diet for just 2 weeks resulted in sustained improvements to the body's immune system.
You see the immune function, like the markers of inflammation, is going down. You see the ability of the immune cells to fight the infections. It's improved. But also we see the markers of the cardiovascular diseases, they're also going down.
Now, this study is small and the cohort is limited. Still, Temba says the insights from it can inform nutritional guidelines all over the world.
For too long now, the global health has followed a one-way street. Like research conducted in the high-income countries lead to recommendations that may not translate well to the African context. But what our study demonstrates is that the opposite flow, like south to north, knowledge transfer is also equally vital.
Speaking of, so I'm in my local Whole Foods, and there is a row of plantains, like just a few. They're a little sad at the end of the bananas. No cassava, though, I don't think. No cassava. But here is a whole bunch of olives and feta. So it looks like, for now, to control my cholesterol, I'm stuck with the Mediterranean diet. But hopefully it won't be that way forever. For The World, I'm Sarah Birnbaum.
We have more cooking ideas and stories from West Africa still to come, plus pink soup. That'll brighten up your picnic table.
It's all part of our summer food show. Stay with us. You're listening to The World.
This is The World. I'm Soraya Wintersmith in for Carolyn Beeler. In the U.S., summer food often means watermelon and corn on the cob and tomatoes from the garden. In the Baltics, it's the season of cold beet soup. Vilnius, Lithuania celebrates the season with a pink soup festival, and Lithuania has made a provocative claim that its version of the soup is better than neighboring Latvia's. And yes, those are fighting words. The World's Daniel Offman reported from last summer's festival.
Pink Soup Festival is only in its second year, but it's already a popular event across Vilnius. This year, more than 1,000 people sat at one table the length of 4 football fields to eat the soup together. They beat spoons against their bowls in anticipation, and later they set a record for most people eating pink soup at the same time. Go Vilnius, the city's tourism agency, hyped up the festival on social media with trendy videos introducing foreigners to the country's favorite summer soup.
It's pink soup season. If you've never had pink soup before, you have not lived. It consists of beetroot, kefir, cucumber, dill, and some spring onions. Everything either gets grated or chopped up really finely, so it's really easy to eat.
Leading up to the festival, the agency turned up the heat, so to speak, proclaiming on Instagram that the Lithuanian soup was better than Latvia's. Both countries claim the dish as their own. But according to Gintare Kavaluninte, who's with Go Vilnius, there's one main difference in how they eat it. Lithuanians serve it with a side of boiled potatoes. Latvians eat it with bread.
For Lithuanians, this is really a strange way to eat pink soup. And we are saying, no, you never eat pink soup with bread. You only eat it with hot boiled potatoes.
In Latvia, Madara Oga, who's with Riga's tourism agency, says there's a simple explanation for how they eat their soup.
Latvians eat rye bread with everything, so bread is our potatoes in this case.
Olga says there are a few other key differences. Latvians use marinated beets, whereas Lithuanians use boiled beets, and Latvians add mustard and horseradish. As the two Baltic countries began trading barbs, Riga's tourism agency doubled down, turning the skirmish into an all-out beef. Lithuania, step back. It's Latvia's game. This cold beet soup, we're claiming the fame. Pink soup from Latvia, get it through your head. Lithuania. The rapper is wearing hot pink from head to toe. She's also making it rain with fresh dill.
Man, they gotta be tripping.
Is this a joke or what?
I don't even know. Is she serious?
It feels like an international conflict, you know?
This might not be Drake versus Kendrick, but Lithuania soon responded with its own diss track. In the soup, we sail, we swim, we sink. If you cut us open, we will bleed pink. At the end of the day, just about everyone in the Baltics bleeds pink. Here's Gintare Kavaluninte from Vilnius again.
The truth is that this soup is loved all over our region, starting with Lithuania, Latvia, Poland. We just enjoy the love and passion that this soup gets from all the region.
Madra Oga from Riga agrees, and she admits that her team is envious of the Pink Soup Festival. But she's still sticking to her guns. She says that Latvia's soup is better. For The World, I'm Daniel Offman, Riga, Latvia. Girl, you don't even know the recipe, and your
rhymes are written by ChatGPT. Sadly, this year's Pink Soup Festival has come and gone, but next year's grudge match is set for May 2026. Mark your calendars.
In Nigeria, yams, corn, and rice have been staples for centuries. But if you spend any time exploring Nigerian cuisine today, you'll quickly find all kinds of global influences and ingredients. This is all brought together in a new cookbook called Chop Chop, Cooking the Food of Nigeria. The World's Carol Hill spoke with the author, Azaz Soko.
So Nigerian fried rice has a base of rice, but also a mix of vegetables and spice blends, curry powder, dried thyme, and two typical meats or proteins that I really like. One's beef liver, and the other is really tiny shrimp or prawns. And these are all just kind of combined to give you this extremely vibrant dish with treasures and nuggets of vegetables and protein. Really, really love it.
And how did it come to be? How did those different global flavors end up in this dish?
Nigeria's had a long relationship with both China and India for 100 years or maybe less, but a very, very strong relationship that has led to various waves of Chinese immigration and Indian immigration to Nigeria at various points of its history. So there are a couple of dishes. Fried rice is one of those. Chinese spring rolls are another, as well as samosas, which I know are originally Persian, but came to Nigeria via India.
Hmm. Now, you use the term global foodways. What does that mean?
It means this connection across geographies, cultures, cuisines, where different countries have foods in common. For instance, at the start of the book, I talk about a bean fritter in the breakfast chapter, a fritter called akara. Akara originated in Nigeria, but today you'll find it everywhere where enslaved West Africans were taken to, from Bahia in Brazil to Haiti to Jamaica. You'll find it across the Caribbean islands. And there's even a version called callus in the American South. So it's just these edible traces that you can map and you can say, oh, people are so similar. We have similar ingredients. We explore similar techniques in processing a particular ingredient. It's all the ways we're connected in spite of our differences. That's what I think of as global foodways.
So each food item has a particular story. What about you? How about your parents? How much of an influence have they been in your love for food?
My parents were a huge influence in my love for food. And actually, my uncles and aunties, they loved cooking. My father was really interested in utensils, equipment, gadgets. He would buy all sorts of things. He was very interested in understanding how things were made. So how foods were made, how flours were made, how they were milled, how they were processed, and all of that. And then my mom was a crafter and explorer. She was the kind of person who would take one dish and work on it forever. Like she would cook it time and time again. And I think that foundational support was really, really important for me.
Azaz, before I let you go, I want to get to the title of your book, Chop Chop. What does that mean?
Chop Chop in Nigeria doesn't mean quick, quick, or hurry up, or let's go. It means a food lover. It means someone who's enthusiastic about food, who loves eating, the process, but also everything about it. And I chose Chop Chop to invite people to come into this space of wanting to be not just curious, but deeply curious. And I hope they themselves become Chop Chops.
That's food writer Azaz Soko talking about her new cookbook, Chop Chop, Cooking the Food of Nigeria. She was speaking with The World's Carol Hills. We have the recipe for Nigerian fried rice at theworld.org.
Junk food is everywhere around the globe, and so is the challenge for parents to keep their kids from eating too much of it. Just ahead, Mexico is trying to help by getting junk food out of schools. You're listening to The World.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Soraya Wintersmith.
Soft drinks, chips, and candy are no longer on the menu in schools in Mexico. No more in school cafeterias or vending machines. It's a relatively recent change thanks to a government-sponsored junk food ban across Mexico's educational institutions and part of an effort to battle what's considered one of the worst childhood obesity and diabetes epidemics in the world.
Dr. Simone Barquera is a member of the Mexican National Academy of Medicine and president of the World Obesity Federation. He spoke with The World's Carolyn Beeler back in March when the ban on junk food in schools took effect.
The ban works by forbidding schools to have available ultra-processed products and all type of products that have warning labels indicating that they are not healthy, and also by banning all the sugary drinks from the school system, including juices and milk with flavor. And this will allow kids to eat healthier, natural, basic foods of much higher nutritional quality.
And free drinking water will have to be supplied by schools, so kids can drink that instead of soda, right?
Yes, exactly. We will promote water fountains so they can get access to water and at the same time no access at all to sugary drinks. And also in the curriculum, there are some components that explain the importance of this. And we have developed information for the parents, for the teachers, and for the kids. So it is going to be a massive education program.
So how did this ban come about? Who pushed for it? And what is the food industry's reaction?
We were trying to take junk food from schools since 2010. So basically, the last 15 years. And the problem is that although the school published guidelines, these were not obligatory. And this time in 2024, modifications to the education law were approved. So now it is by law that they need to comply. And there are strong sanctions for schools and school authorities if they don't comply with this.
So the policy has some teeth now, whereas before it did not, meaning that you're hoping that food available in schools will be healthier. But I understand that vendors outside, maybe just on the sidewalk outside of schools, you know, can still sell whatever they want. So is this going to have much of an impact, this ban?
Well, junk food corporations are always looking at ways to neutralize this kind of policy. So we are going to see an increase in the offer outside the schools. But at least right now, we are protecting the school environment.
Kids all over the place love to eat food that is not good for them. Why is the situation in Mexico with childhood obesity and diabetes particularly severe?
We observed during the end of the 80s and 90s an increase in consumption of soft drinks and a lot of junk food. And we think it is basically the change with the free trade agreement and all these corporations coming here to commercialize products with heavy marketing directed to children.
So you think that the change in Mexico specifically is a result of free trade agreements that made packaged food more widely available from producers in, for example, the U.S.?
Yes, we saw how the food environment changed during those years. So, for example, consumption of soft drinks increased like 40% in 10 years after the free trade, and consumption of vegetables or beans decreased during the same period, very importantly. So, yes, we know that the food system is changing and we need to help to modify this trend if we want to have healthier children.
Mexico has already taken some steps to curb obesity, including mandatory labels that started to be required in 2020 for products high in salt, sugar, calories and fat. Do you know what impact that has had so far?
Yes, it has had a very important impact. And with these warning labels, the average content of sugar in fizzy drinks decreased by 6 to 7 grams per liter. And on top of that, there was a reduction in consumption of about 30% in these sugary drinks nationally.
Interesting. Have junk food bans in schools been enacted in other countries? And if so, what does the research show about how well they work?
One of the gold standards, in my opinion, is obviously there are many like Japan, some parts of France, but the gold standard for us is Brazil because we have a lot of similarities with this country. And in Brazil, they banned all junk food and they installed popular kitchens. And the kitchens, by law, are supplied from products that are made by the communities. So this system has allowed what for amazing results, including not only healthy nutrition, but also agroecology and self-production, also friendly with the environment. And we would like to be closer to that model and far away from having our kids learning to eat junk food since very early.
Simón Barquera is a member of the Mexican National Academy of Medicine. He's also president of the World Obesity Federation.
Let's take you now to the Pacific coast of Japan. In Shizuoka Prefecture, green tea cultivation is a major industry. More than a third of the tea leaves produced in Japan come from the region. Shizuoka is beautiful. Hillsides are covered in neat rows of bright green tea bushes. Mount Fuji is towering on the horizon. That scenery is changing, though. Reporter Hannah Kirshner headed to Shizuoka to find out why so many tea farmers are throwing in the towel.
When I arrive at the farm stay where I'll spend my first night in Shizuoka, a bulldozer is ripping out tea bushes. My host, Yoko Miyake, tells me her husband farmed tea until about 15 years ago. After her husband passed away, she leased the fields to another farmer. This spring, that farmer called it quits, too. The wholesale price of tea leaves went even lower this year. She says it's better to get out. Miyake is clearing away tea bushes to make way for a patio, where her guests can enjoy a cookout or drink a cup of tea. On a walk around the neighborhood, I see some tidy, active tea fields, and right next to them, wild, overgrown, neglected fields. I meet a retired farmer in his 90s. He points towards his tea fields way up on the mountainside. His tenant quit farming, too. Everyone is ending their leases, he tells me. It's a big problem. The fields are no longer a good source of income, and when they're neglected, they become an eyesore. My guide on this walk is Satoshi Nihon Yanagi. He arranged my homestay, too.
So what we do is, well, actually what I do is to help local elderly people to sustain their own lives by tourism.
For the 30 or 40 farmers he works with, hosting guests like me is a way to make a little extra income, especially now that it's become so difficult to make a living growing tea. Nihon Yanagi explains that the tea market has very specific economics. Most farmers pool their leaves with a local cooperative and sell them at auction. Buyers do the final processing and packaging. Tea can be harvested 4 times a year: spring, early summer, late summer, and autumn. Nihon Yanagi writes these down and draws a line.
So you basically just drew a downward slope from the first harvest to the last harvest.
Every spring, the earliest tea harvested in all of Japan fetches the highest price at auction. And from there, the price just falls. Shizuoka has a relatively late first harvest. And on the tea market, that puts the region at a disadvantage.
This region is, you know, surrounded by mountains, so they don't have enough sunshine.
And it has nothing to do with the taste of the tea, because the tea that gets some shade actually tastes better, right?
Much better, yes.
Shizuoka specializes in a style of green tea called sencha. If you buy a bottle of Japanese green tea from a vending machine or convenience store, that's usually sencha. That mass-produced bottled tea was introduced in the 90s, and it changed the tea industry. Overall tea consumption in Japan is actually pretty steady, but year by year, bottled tea consumption is overtaking the kind of tea you brew yourself.
I've heard people say that young people don't know how to brew tea. Do you think it's
right,
true?
That's right.
Because they only ever drank tea from a plastic bottle.
Yes, that's right.
The popular bottled tea company Itoen buys about a quarter of all the leaves that go to auction. Nihon Yanagi tells me that these bottled tea companies buy the autumn harvest, when the price is lowest. That's why a lot of older farmers are giving up on tea altogether. But some young farmers have a different idea. They're trying to create an alternative tea market by selling directly to consumers. They stand out by making organic or naturally farmed tea, tea that expresses a sense of place, or black tea. In another mountain village, about an hour away, I meet Hiroki Hojo, president of Green 8 Tea Company. Hojo is 44, young in this industry. He took over tea farming from his father. I think the industry has a chance to change, Hojo tells me. We're sitting in the cafe attached to his tea factory, where you can get a black tea-flavored ice cream parfait or shaved ice. Green 8 specializes in a product Hojo calls not bitter black tea. Since everyone was aiming for the kind of black tea you drink with milk and sugar, we thought we'd go the other way, says Hojo. I sip a cup of his plain black tea.
Yeah, it's not bitter at all. It has a very gentle taste.
They still make green tea too, but Hojo says it's tough to get new customers with just green tea. Green 8 has been marketing their black tea for 12 years now. They recently opened a second cafe and shop in Shizuoka Station, a big, bustling train station. But Hojo says this isn't a success story yet. He hopes someone will want to take over his business one day, keep growing tea, and keep innovating. That's his definition of success. In a tea field nearby, Green 8 has a spot to snap photos.
Okay, and then there's this little platform in the middle of the tea field and some stumps we can sit on and pose. Oh, actually, this is beautiful.
Yeah.
You can see down into the valley and these steep mountains behind it.
If Green 8 and small companies like it succeed, maybe you'll still be able to see this kind of scenery a generation from now. For The World, I'm Hannah Kirshner, in the tea fields of Shizuoka, Japan.
Reporting from Japan is made possible by a grant from the U.S.-Japan Foundation. Find more of those stories online at theworld.org.
In the film The Martian, Matt Damon plays an astronaut left behind on Mars. He figures out how to grow potatoes.
It's been 48 sols since I planted the potatoes, so now it's time to reap and re-sow. They grew even better than I expected. I now have 400 healthy potato plants.
In real life, though, if humans want to make food in space, they're going to have to take the technology with them. This spring, the European Space Agency made some first steps in that direction. It sent a mini food lab known as a bioreactor into space aboard a SpaceX rocket for a 3-hour flight. The goal is to have a working food production plant on the International Space Station within several years.
Akhil Shamsul is the CEO of Frontier Space, a British biotech company that is one of the partners in this effort. When we spoke back in April, I asked him to describe that bioreactor.
The way I view it is it's like a cooking pot or an oven. Fundamentally, what you do is you put your microbes in there, you put them in a nice controlled environment. Essentially, it's a growing vessel for microbes. So let's say we have a yeast, for example. We put them in a bioreactor, bring it into space, we grow them, and then the yeast will produce proteins that we want to use for our application. And this could be from biomaterial, pharmaceutical, or fuel.
The rocket was in space for 3 hours. Now it's back down on Earth. When you examine the returned bioreactor, what are you going to be looking for?
There will be some influence in terms of the environment it endured, going up, going down. And even though the small time frame of microgravity, fundamentally what we will do is we will bring it back down, bring the sample to Imperial, and Imperial will do a lot of post-analysis, just trying to understand how does the biology experience and can we still grow them after all of this journey.
You mentioned Imperial. That's Imperial College in London, which you're collaborating
yes.
with. Yeah. So let's scale back any kind of hopes that you'll send this bioreactor up in space and you'll come back with a steak. I mean, how far away is that concept?
Yeah, so it depends on how much funding goes into this development. The technology that we're developing now is a smaller scale bioreactor, and what we're trying to do is trying to get a larger scale within a 2 years timeline. This allows us to grow the larger proteins, but there's one or two steps after that. Is that how do we extract the proteins? How do we then powderize them to make them into, I don't know, steak using a 3D bioprinter, for example?
Do the basic facts of being in space limit what you'll actually be able to grow in a space-based lab?
Yeah, so I mean, this is something that is the next frontier, right? I think there's a lot of study that still needs to be done in space environment, but the idea of using synthetic biology to produce specific protein is something relatively new. There will be some impact of microgravity in terms of growing the microbes, but there's also been studies showing that they can actually aggregate and yield better production. So there's still sort of uncharted territory that we need to navigate.
Yeah, and with the ISS, the International Space Station, I mean, you've got a lot of different food cultures to address.
Mm-hmm.
The food's got to be appetizing and taste good, whether you're in outer space or not. How are you going about creating tasty food?
Again, this is very important, right? I think for morale, just having a nice food that someone can relate, it's extremely important. So the benefit of actually using this kind of precision fermentation is that we can actually cultivate flavor profile compounds, for example. So we can actually make Indian cuisine, Chinese cuisine, to be able to really just produce that food that we can relate to for morale purposes.
Would it be possible to build a platform for growing food in space that could reside in the International Space Station? Or would it be somehow like attached to it, like almost like a greenhouse?
Yeah, so in a short sense, yes. For the International Space Station, however, I mean, one of the issues that we're facing is that it is currently due to be decommissioned within 5 years. So we need to start thinking about how we can integrate this to the newer infrastructure that's coming up.
I'm wondering, Akhil, if when you get to the food kind of proof of concept and it's at scale, are you going to be an official taste tester?
It's a good question. I don't know if you've seen the news piece. So BBC was covering this, and we actually did a taste test where the chef did a dumpling. The flavor is there. Obviously, there's still some things that need to be fixed, but it's not off-putting. It can actually be quite a nice, tasty meal.
What kind of dumpling was it?
It was basically ground up yeast put into a dumpling shell. Ginger taste.
Mm.
Yeah.
Even in space, they say bon appetit. Akhil Shamsul is the CEO of Frontier Space, a British biotech company, part of the European Space Agency's project to make food in space.
Coming up in Uganda, bananas everywhere, and farmers there are betting on more than one way to use the massive harvests. That story, plus some really charming chickens in Italy, just ahead. You're listening to The World.
People in Uganda eat more bananas per capita than anyone else on Earth. It's a rather astonishing amount, about 2 pounds per person per day. That's around 8 average-sized bananas. The farmers who grow all those bananas are struggling to make ends meet. Some entrepreneurs, though, are working on a solution. Reporter Anita Elash brings us a story from central Uganda.
Like, you see what they're doing? Yeah, we get them into different sheets.
At the Texfad textile factory in Mukono district, workers are processing hundreds of banana trees. First, they separate the trees into layers, sort of like separating an onion. Then they extract the fibers by running the sheets through a small diesel-powered mill.
Yeah, so this is the banana fiber.
This is the banana fiber.
Now, from the stem, the 15% is this.
The fibers look a bit like sisal rope. Once they're dried and processed, Texfad turns them into a range of biodegradable products. Spun into yarn and woven into fabric, combined with cotton to make bandages, or baked, washed, and combed, and turned into hair extensions and wigs. It's part of a search for new uses for this abundant crop. Most of Texfad's products are still in development, but business manager John Okello says there's enormous potential here.
Banana grows in almost every African country, and there's nothing being done about it.
Okello says most of the value from bananas is actually in the plant, which usually ends up as compost or in landfill. Extracting and selling the fiber, he says, can double a farmer's income.
These things can actually change our economy. Imagine you're supplying hair to the whole country, to the whole continent, to the whole world.
The technology to transform banana fiber into other useful products has existed for at least 80 years. It's being used elsewhere to make textiles on a small scale.
Simply, it's an excellent product.
Ronnie Swenin is an agronomist and a global banana expert with the nonprofit International Institute of Tropical Agriculture. He says the banana plant could be an important part of a sustainable economy.
In the search of getting away from plastics, some of the products are as good as plastics or sometimes even better.
Researchers have identified 140 products that can be made from the banana plant. The fibers are especially strong. What's missing when it comes to developing new products, says Swenin, is someone to make a business case.
We need an economist coming in to say, what's the market? What's the competition? How much can we produce? And everybody will be stunned about the potential.
This is how we cut our bananas for harvest.
Jotam Tugumisirize isn't an economist, but he sees himself as a great example of that potential.
The best way to make some money out of banana is to add value.
Add value or use bananas in new ways. He farms 10 acres on a large plantation just outside the capital city, Kampala. He says growing matoki for food doesn't always pay.
We saw sometimes you'd have bumper harvests when the market is full of bananas and you find you are selling very cheaply. So that's when the idea of value addition came in.
So he started making sweet banana wine, and he's not afraid to promote it.
It is sweet and good. It is actually better than most wine produced locally here.
He's got other experiments in the works as well. His earnings have increased, but it's also been a big investment. And most Ugandan banana farmers don't have access to that kind of money. For The World, Anita Elash, Uganda.
Italians looking to avoid eggflation have been flocking to a farm in northern Italy for classes on how to raise their own hens. Reporter Danny Mitzman brings us the story from our partner Deutsche Welle, DW.
I'm in the kitchen of homeopathic vet Pietro Venezia on his farm just outside the town of Forlì. Featuring plenty of their fresh produce, his wife Laura's laid on a very tasty lunch for those attending today's course. Pietro's farm uses the technique of permaculture, a way of creating a sustainable and self-sufficient ecosystem, and central to this method are his chickens. He's been showing us around the spacious coop, together with permaculture specialist Andrea Minchio. They teach happy chicken husbandry.
We started the courses like 5 years ago, and the courses were full. So that's why we decided to jump from the course to the book.
Galline Felici in Permacultura, which translates as happy hens in permaculture, came out late last year. It's an exhaustive manual on how to create the ideal environment for your chooks. Whether you've got a sprawling farm or just a little back garden, Pietro and Andrea explain how to build the perfect chicken coop.
We already have some hens, but having only got them recently, we've now realized you need to plan the chicken shed well and get to know the animals inside out to understand what's good and bad for them.
Caterina inherited 10 chickens from her late grandfather, but hopes to have a lot more on the farm she and her husband are planning to start.
My granddad's way of looking after them wasn't ideal, so we completely rebuilt the chicken coop. We saw that it really worked, and the chickens were happier in their improved space.
Pietro has a genuine passion for chickens and teaches you how to create an area to give your animals freedom but also protection from predators. And he helps you design their indoor spaces with separate areas to roost and lay eggs. A far cry from industrial chicken farming.
The situation of chickens in the world is very sad. We're talking about billions of animals. They never see the sky or the sun or a pasture. And if you're talking about chickens for meat, we're talking about animals that they live between 39 and 43 days. So they're just born and die. We want to share with the people some things that we know to see if we can find better life for chickens. That is a wonderful animal.
Pietro tells me chickens are among the most adaptable animals in the world, which is why you'll find them in the hottest and coldest corners of the globe. But there is one question they still haven't answered. Which came first, the chicken or the egg?
We know the answer.
Go on then.
Dinosaurs. First the egg or first the dinosaurs? I don't know.
But for sure, first the dinosaurs.
Before the chickens, yeah. Definitely.
Danny Mitzman reporting there in Florae, Italy, for our partners DW Deutsche Welle.
From the celebratory coals of a barbecue to DIY free-range chicken farming, that is our global food tour. The World is produced by GBH and PRX, broadcasting weekdays from the Nan and Bill Harris studio in Boston and from the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Soraya Wintersmith. Thanks for listening.
The World is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people. From the Carnegie Corporation of New York, working to reduce political polarization through philanthropic support for education, democracy, and peace. More information at carnegie.org. By the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. macfound.org. By the PRX Ambassador Council, whose members include Henry Becton, Richard Gingras, Betsy Gardella and Jim Smith, Rima Heider and Camilo Villa, and the Patchwork Collective. The World's theme music is composed by Ned Porter. The World is a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX.
from PHP.